Welcome to episode 2 of A Legitimate Salvage, a podcast about The Expanse, in which 4 friends slash Doctor Who fans potentially ill-advisedly attempt to rewatch seasons 1 to 3 before season 4 premieres on Amazon in December. Let's go around and introduce ourselves before we launch into the discussions of episodes 3 and episode 4 of the first season of The Expanse.
I'm Jen Burt.
I am Katie Burt.
I'm Warren Fry.
And I'm Chip Sutterth. And who says that this is ill-advised?
I may be projecting some things about my busy schedule onto this. But you know what? I'm enjoying it. You're right. It is. Did I say definitely ill-advised? I said potentially ill-advised.
Potentially ill-advised. Now, I did have a friend say, you know, Chip, you could watch a TV show without podcasting about it.
No. Blasphemy.
Well, we want to put ourselves to work.
I know. Yeah. I like when we were watching, Jen and I watched episodes 3 and 4 together, rewatched episodes 3 and 4 before this very night before recording this podcast. And at one point I just said aloud, I was like, I'm so happy we're rewatching these episodes because I don't get it. I think in before the era of peak TV, I more often rewatch things before the new season or it was more fresh in my mind, or there were fewer things, so I just remembered things more intensely. I don't know. I was younger. My brain was fresher. But I don't get to do that a lot, and having this as an excuse, I guess, has been really cool. I'm really excited to watch season 4 after having rewatched these things, because every episode we rewatch, I'm like, I forgot completely about that thing.
Totally. And this is so dense. I mean, I don't know about the rest of you, but when I got to CQB, I was like, and this is why rewatching is beneficial and why I have to watch carefully, because I started to get a little bit lost in CQB about all of the stuff that was going on. I felt like I really had to be paying attention.
Definitely. And we like to give a quick-ish synopsis of what happened in the episodes we're talking about in case there's people listening who maybe haven't had a chance to rewatch those episodes. So, Chip, if you want to talk about what happened in Remember the Cant.
Absolutely. That was, and Remember the Cant aired first on December 15th, 2015 online. It was on broadcast December 22nd on the Sci-Fi Channel. So, 3 points. Point the first. The whole solar system has heard Holden's accusation that Mars blew up the Canterbury, and the Belters on Ceres take it as an attack on them. So this is an episode that's full of character data dumps once the Mars Doniger crew interrogate our folks. James Holden washed out of the Earth Navy rather than violate principles. Alex is former Mars Navy. Naomi is accused of being in the radical Belter OPA faction, the Outer Planets Alliance. Amos is, well, he's just Amos. He just is. And Shad's a screw-up. And of the 5 of them, nobody trusts nobody. Meanwhile on Earth, Christian Avassarala manipulates the UN ambassador to Mars, lying to him that they have proof that the Cant was destroyed by Mars stealth ships. So, of course, the ambassador checks up on Mars and inadvertently proves that Mars is innocent and exposes their secret facilities, which is a win for Earth. So he's upset. He ends his friendship with Christian. And as he does that, we get her character data dump, which is that she will manipulate or burn anyone to win. But at least that she figured out whoever attacked Canterbury is trying to start a war. Point the third. Meanwhile, on Ceres, Miller is taken off of the Julie Mao case, even though he figured out that she was on the ship that Holden investigated. But Miller just can't let this one, or her, go. He makes contact with OPA leader Anderson Dawes just before tensions on Ceres explode into a riot, and Miller's partner Havelock is one of the victims. He got spiked, and that was Remember the Cant.
And we're also talking about CQB, episode 4 of the first season, which was also made available originally online on December 15th, 2015, but aired on December 29th, 2015. And I think this episode could maybe have been titled When the Ship That Rescued You Needs Rescuing Too, because we catch back up with what's happening on the Doniger. Holden is once again has a front row seat to some very politically relevant events that are happening when ships like the one that destroyed the Canterbury attack the Doniger while he is on the bridge being questioned by their captain. Captain Yao and her crew are very unconcerned about this attack. Captain Yao doesn't even really put down her morning coffee throughout most of the attack. Until it becomes apparent that the mysterious stealth ships have superior military technology and prowess. So Yao assigns Lopez, who is a character who's been interrogating the remaining members of the Canterbury crew in the previous episode, to get Holden off the ship so that he can testify that someone, they still don't know who, is trying to frame Mars and the destruction of the Canterbury before, you know, Captain Yao blows up the entire ship, because that's how Martians roll. Holden insists that his crew come along. Mine is shed because he's dead. Splash. Also, while trying to escape the Doniger, Lopez properly introduces the mystery of Phoebe Station. So the Doniger was tasked with investigating when Research Station Phoebe went silent for several weeks, only to find everyone on board dead and the computer cores destroyed. Dun, dun, dun. Meanwhile, on Sirius, Miller investigates the death of a man who matched with Julie Mao on Tinder, or so it seemed. It turns out the corpse has an ID spoofer mod, which spits out false identities. So who is this dead guy with a memory crypt filled with government documents in his calf? I actually don't remember.
Right.
So no, we can discuss that later, maybe. Meanwhile, nobody seems to care about Havelock, who we're revealed at the very end of this episode doesn't die somehow from the previous episode when he's spiked through the chest. But no one's really looking for him, so that's sad, too. And that is what happens on CQB. So for those of you who didn't listen to last week's episode, I forgive you. And also, some relevant information. For the first half of our episode, we're going to attempt to discuss these episodes without dropping spoilers for any episodes past episode 4 of the first season. So the episodes we've discussed already and are discussing in this episode. Said episodes a lot there. We'll be sure to let you know when we're entering the spoiler zone. So rewatchers, be sure to stick around for that discussion if you'd like to discuss these episodes more in the context of not only what happens in them, but what comes after. So first of all, I wanted to talk about Havelock because we actually get to spend a lot of time with him and Remember the Cant. I think in the first scene, he's the one who brings us through what's happening on Ceres. And then he's almost completely absent in CQB for, you know, obvious reasons. I was curious how you guys are all feeling about his character. Just in general. I think Chip maybe has some thoughts, but maybe other people have some strong Havelock reactions.
One thing I like about Havelock is how he actually engages with the Mormon. But even while watching that, I was like, you're not going to go to that meeting next week. There's no way. This is some good social skills or what's a word for when hackers, social engineering. But it doesn't really ring true that he's actually going to listen to this guy. I mean, he is the good cop to Miller's bad cop, but is he that good a cop, really? When you get down to it?
I mean, he punked the captain. You know, he's like, My name is Shadid. Keep calling. You know, if you can't get through, keep calling. And
yeah,
I got the sense that, especially in retrospect, you knew that he was going to be near to the point of death when he suddenly became so very interesting in this episode.
Yes, that's a good point.
This is the one that starts out with him trying to learn Belter culture and learn the language and stuff like that. So, you know, he's really trying. It's like he's becoming a real person. So, of course, he's got to get a spike through the chest.
And I like how they fake you out, like he's at a brothel and you're like, oh, it's a guy going to a brothel. And then it's like, no, he's going to a brothel to learn Belter.
Yeah. Do you think his position as, because we have other people on this, on series who are Earthers on series, and that creates an interesting tension and dynamic and perspective. But he is one who seemingly just showed up or hasn't been there very long. Is that helpful as a viewer who also hasn't been there very long in theory? I mean, we have, but yeah, I don't know. I think that he does play an interesting role. And I remember the first time I watched these episodes, I did connect with his character.
But even though Miller's a Belter, he still fills that role too because he acts like an Earth guy, which makes him stand out amongst all the other people who call him on it continuously.
Yeah, that's Miller true. Miller code switches a lot.
He does.
And that's one of the fascinating things about him early on. Havelock's just, yeah, he's sort of an audience surrogate, I guess.
Yeah, and you mentioned the scene where we see him trying to learn the Belter language. For me, this felt like the third episode was more of an introduction to the Belter language and through that, the Belter culture for viewers. But I couldn't tell if it was just because this was the first episode of the rewatch I watched with captions. So I was curious if you guys felt the same way.
So did I. Yeah. I did the caption thing too.
The captions at certain points try to transcribe it and sometimes just say foreign language. Which is
which is true.
Yeah. Which is how the, you know, sometimes they are speaking in almost like a mix of what we would understand as English. And then it's sometimes it's like almost incomprehensible. So it is interesting to see what they label as that and what is just some weird letters they've jammed together.
And what you're supposed to understand as a viewer, because you're not supposed to understand all of it. And when you have captions on, I think that actually can give you information that maybe you're not supposed to have. But whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I do wish that, you know, in these early episodes, they do switch out of the Belter Creole and just go into just bracket foreign language, close bracket. And I wish that was a little more accessible because for deaf and hard of hearing, you pick up some stuff, hearing viewers to the show, you know, you pick up a lot from context, from tone of voice, and from, you know, just even though you don't know the words that are being used, you figure it out. And I'd like the captions to do a little bit more work there to help people who need the captions.
For sure. I also think it's interesting they kind of introduce that body language and kind of like hand signals are important in the Belter language. And it's only a little bit with her giving Havelock lessons, but I do think that's an interesting kind of introduction there.
Well, they also hint at it with Naomi's interrogation scene, which is a really cool connection and also very subtle. I love when stories, TV shows trust viewers to figure things out without hitting you over the head with it. And when he is like very adamant about seeing her hands and her, you know, kind of inadvertently making certain signals with her hands because, you know, when you're nervous, you maybe say things or express things that you don't want to, is such a cool way of grounding her in the Belter culture and like just just communicating to the viewers that she is a Belter through and through, especially with while this question of is she OPA, where are her allegiances, is like such a it's a part of the mystery of this episode.
Right. And the
I also think that one of the reasons they do the Belter stuff at the beginning is because you're going to meet Anderson Dawes later, and that he's kind of a key figure in Belter. So you're going to need to know what this guy represents, you know, before you meet him.
Yeah, and I wanted to talk about the introduction of Anderson Dawes, because I think even if you haven't watched past this episode, you can tell he's an important figure. Maybe because he's played by Jared Harris, but maybe not. And he has just like, I think one of the best, Jen and I were talking about one of the best character introductions. Yeah, how do you guys feel about the introduction of Anderson Dawes? Do you think he's introduced as a sympathetic character? How is that complicated if it is?
I think he's introduced as a voice of reason, which he always is, even if he's cunning and not entirely honest about it, but he's always a voice of reason.
And they do a very good job of introducing him as both someone who can walk in and give a speech and clearly has a ton of power within both Belters and OPA. Mm-hmm. But I also like that they pair it with the scene of him talking to Miller and really questioning Miller and his allegiances and trying to figure out where he can push him and where he can't.
Yeah, he's a real politic kind of guy. When he defends the Martian who was being screwed out of his water ration, and you know he's not doing it for Mars. You know, he's Belter first through and through, but he makes a point that this is not the time, and that you don't want to convince your opponents that you're just as bad as they are. You know, he's definitely an interesting figure.
Yeah, and not to jump too far ahead, but it doesn't feel dissimilar. Like his logic there doesn't feel dissimilar to the Martian's logic when they're like, you need to protect Holden with your life and get him off the ship. Where it's like, this is not someone that they even like or have allegiance to, but what they need to do strategically and what makes sense logically is for him to survive. And I don't know, those moments are very powerful. I mean, that one, the Martian one, is much more extended than the Anderson Dawes moment with the Martian and the water, but episodes 3 and 4 are so much stronger to me than episodes 1 and 2. And if I hadn't remembered how quickly the show like got so beautiful and so resonant
and so deep.
Intricate and mm-hmm. so deep.
Yeah.
So like thematically deep, like some of the dialogue in these episodes, it's just like, I feel like you could write a whole essay about just one line.
I think so many of these characters, one of my favorite other science fiction shows is Babylon 5, which I've podcasted about at length at The Audio Guide to Babylon 5. And one of the characters has a great quote. It's a little wordy. It's a quote that wouldn't fly on The Expanse, but the character says, "The universe is run by the complex interweaving of three elements, energy, matter, and enlightened self-interest." And there's enlightened self-interest all over the place in these two episodes.
I need to watch Babylon 5.
Have I told you the good news about Babylon 5 yet?
We did already touch upon Miller and his conversation with Dawes, which includes Dawes asking him about Julie Mao, saying, "Other than the money, why do you care about her?" Mm-hmm. And we also see his ex-partner, Mus, refer to the investigation as the cute girl kidnapped side job, which I kind of want to be an episode title, but is not.
That sounds like an episode of Leverage.
Yeah. We talked a little bit about Miller last week. I'm curious how everyone's feeling. I'm particularly interested in hearing from Chip, but no pressure, Chip. Because I think maybe you are engaged with the Miller character a little bit more than the rest of us. And I think that's cool. I like to hear about, you know, how people...
You like to hear about how people care about characters you don't? Is that what you're saying?
I'm always interested in... This is something that I felt really strongly about the Magician season 4 finale, where it had so many different... very strong reactions in different directions to the same piece of content. And I just, yeah, I'm always really curious about that. And like, especially when it's people who I think engage on the same level as I do. Cause there's like, you know, obviously casual viewers and then there's losers who have podcasts about their shows.
Wow. That got skinny real quick.
That was harsh. I don't believe that. We're great, you guys. But we obviously think about these things a lot more than a casual viewer would. And yeah, I mean, the Miller character is a central character in the first season. And he's one that I have trouble connecting with. And he's often the one that Sterling is often the one I'm least interested in. But obviously he's mm-hmm. important to a lot of viewers and is very important to the story moving forward.
Yeah.
So does anyone have any thoughts about where Miller is at this point and... yeah, how they're feeling about his character.
Well, if I can give a tiny little peek for the listeners who are just watching The Expanse for the first time right now, I'm going to give you a tiny little peek into our spoiler conversation from the last podcast, where I was asking, you know, I was going to be paying attention to when Miller sort of really commits to this Julie Mao investigation, and that happened here in episode 3. And he's asked by Dawes and Muzz, you know, why the big deal? Why are you making such a big deal? And he already doesn't have a good answer for that. So I think that he is committed to the Julie Mao investigation because the plot demands that he be committed to it. I don't see,
and his archetype does
yeah,
too.
Archetype, yeah. I don't see a really strong one other than she is an attractive lost waif, and he is and
so, a rich girl too.
Yeah, so we questioned in the spoiler section, you know, whether it was creepy, and it feels mildly yeah. creepy at this point.
It never uncreeps, as far as I'm concerned. But.
Yeah, so you know, and I'll talk later on as we watch more episodes about why I feel a bit an affinity for the Miller character. But I think it's more of a style thing than, you know, I'm enjoying watching the detective stuff happening. But the Julie Mao connection to him right now at this point, it's just one step up from a character saying, I don't know, I've just got a feeling.
It basically is that.
I think, you know, the parts of him, you know, I think the most boring scene to me in these episodes was when they're in the morgue, and I'm just like, ah, space morgue. I mean, they're trying to introduce some techno babble about the various implants and things that the corpse has, which I think is hard to deliver in some ways for both the actors. It's, you know, I also don't like how he treats he brings Mus in to like get her expertise, and then again is very dismissive to her. I do really like what I do. I'm trying to think of like what I do like about Miller's character, and the scene with him and Jared Harris, and just the which is partly because they're both great actors, and mm-hmm. you can sit them both at a table and just have them have a conversation, and it's interesting. But I also think there is an interesting part to Miller working for an Earth corporation and still feeling some level of connection to himself as a Belter, and where do his allegiance lie, and how much of that plays out over the course of the series, I think is really interesting. And maybe I talk more about that in the spoiler part. But I do think that idea of there are some Belters who are very loyal completely to either the political cause of the OPA. He's kind of someone who is, you know, sold out in some way.
I mean, he's working for Earth Security, so...
Yeah, exactly. You know. But he does have these moments where he maybe feels bad about that.
I think for me, part of the frustration with Miller's character is I think there are these moments where he is very fascinating and interesting to me and could continue to be, because there... It's very realistic to have, like, a man, especially one who maybe who has a chip on his shoulder and, like, is, you know, wants to be seen as an earther in some way, who is looking for this beautiful woman who he doesn't actually know, who is an earther, who is also, like, torn between two worlds, doesn't feel like she belongs where she was born. But I think when the show fails him in some ways, in a way that it usually doesn't fail its characters, in that when... I think, aligns the narrative too closely with his point of view instead of putting it more of a context, maybe. Yeah, it, like, removes a lot of the complication and maybe, yeah, I mean, I would think, like, critical context, but I think if we had more of that context, I would find his character more sympathetic, maybe, or I don't know, more... There are moments when I'm very endeared to him, like when he's listening to his jazz. But yeah, I don't know. We don't need to keep talking about Miller. But I think he's a very important character to dissect, because there's a lot of characters like him in mainstream storytelling.
I have two not so deep Miller, sort of Miller adjacent observations. One, he's always using like his little slab of plastic or whatever. And that is the only reason that exists is because it looks cool. A transparent phone or whatever that is completely useless. Like it drives me nuts whenever I see it, because I'm like, nobody would actually use these things. You can't see it. You look through it. It doesn't make any sense. And the other thing is, for a down on his luck cop, that's a pretty sweet pad he's got on like some station somewhere. Yeah. I'm like, that's a pretty nice place. I wouldn't mind living there.
I know, like, unwinding at the end of the day. It seems very nice.
Yeah.
Which I guess is maybe part of him, like, you know, selling out to some respect, in some respect.
I know how much real estate porn you guys get in North Carolina or Massachusetts, but here there's a lot of it, and his place looks like real estate porn.
Yes.
My last thought about Miller is that it's not so much about Miller himself, but the storyline that he's part of. We got some heavy-duty pew-pew-pew with Holden and the Doninger and all of that stuff in these two episodes. And having the contrast of the sort of the detective story in a different part of the universe, I do like that. And so, mm-hmm. you know, I can deal with some of the deficiencies in the writing around the Miller character, because the change in settings and Thomas Jane's performance lifted up for me.
Yeah, and being what for me is, at least this point, the least interesting storyline in some ways is on this show, from my perspective, is still like, you're doing great. I still, there's still so much to enjoy about this. There's so much world building, and like, his character's still very complex. It's just like, in this wonderful show, maybe there are things that I wish they did a little bit better with him. But yeah, more to discuss. And Warren, you were touching a little bit on some of those like cool like gimmicks of his like handheld device. And there are, the show is so beautiful, and there are a lot of like beautiful visual storytelling moments in these episodes.
Oh, yeah.
And I was curious if any of you had favorite examples from these two.
I mean, those doodads, like, well, he'll just swipe something as you get something on his phone, and then it goes onto the TV, and that helps move the story along in a way. You know, I mean, it's because it's kind of a punctuation mark. This is, hey, this is important. So, yeah, and you couldn't really do it without that. So that, I think that's cool that they worked that into the story.
Yeah, I really love the scene of Holden and Naomi like dashing across the bridge in the on the Doniger with the sparks flying. And it's one that's both beautiful, but also, you know, Jen and I were talking about like they make a lot of really smart like budget choices in that episode, in terms of not actually showing, it's like it stays very contained in terms of you don't see anyone who's shooting, you don't know where, necessarily where that's coming from, but having, I don't know, just having these sparks fly around them creates a sense of chaos, and you know, there's no dialogue in those scene, in that scene, but yeah, you know exactly what's going on, how people feel about it. You know, pretty simple emotional reaction in those moments, I'd imagine. But it's just an example of a show having the budget and interest in telling a visually interesting story in a way that I really appreciate.
On the other end of the spectrum, I'm a big fan of the scene where Christian Evasarala is lying on the roof, looking up at the stars and talking to her grandchild.
Oh, that's one of my favorites, too. I think, like, it's both... I mean, I'm a sucker for any of those, like, sort of people looking at the stars and discussing, you know, what they mean, what's going on, connecting it to their own story. But it's also beautiful. It's just, yeah, with the leaves, her amazing outfit, it just, yeah.
Yeah, and it's really sweet up until the point when you pay attention to what she's saying, which, you know, yes. if her grandson was actually paying attention, you know, she'd be scaring the hell out of him because she's talking about, you know, the meteors that the asteroid that took out the dinosaurs. She's talking about, you know, the dangers of life and all this other stuff. And, you know, I'm really hoping that the child just forgot about this and wasn't paying attention and goes off to a nice bed.
I really paint her just to, for a second as super ruthless in these early episodes. And she's not, you know, she's tough in the later ones, but not to give spoilers away, she isn't quite as hard-edged there as she is here, to the point where it's kind of like, oh, will she do that? Like in this episode where she basically betrays her long-term friend, like screws him over essentially. And
she does. And yet in the service of that, she gets to a point where she realizes and she shares with all of the other politicians and bureaucrats, she figures out that Mars didn't destroy the Canterbury, which is interesting. And, you know, they were on such a war, you know, is this a war footing? Is what, you know, everybody's ready to shoot something. You know, the Admiral Souther, I believe is his name, is the voice of reason there. She burns her friend. And yet the result of that is that she has information which she shares that whatever's going on is more complex than just Earth versus Mars. And that probably cools down the tensions a little bit. So she's ruthless, but she's not, as far as we can tell at this point, a warmonger.
She's very good at her job, which I enjoy.
Yeah, she's exceptional at her job.
And I also think up until this point, it's not necessarily clear... You know that, you know, she says again and again, then she puts Earth first, and that's obvious. But you're not sure if that means, that she might create, you know, fake evidence against Mars? Or, like, does she put Earth first? Does her interpretation of that value mean, you know, Mars has to be destroyed or whatever? And I think in this episode you realize that she is not that person. She's not interested in destruction or war for the sake of it. She genuinely just cares that Earth is safe, which comes with its own ethical implications and you can view in different ways. But I think by the end of this episode you realize how good at her job she is, and you also realize how rigid, I guess, her moral compass is. And there's kind of like a comfort to that, in the sense that you know exactly who she is and she knows exactly who she is. And in a world where there still feels like a lot of uncertainty in terms of allegiance or whatever, she's actually a very simple character, is the wrong way of putting it, but
driven,
or like, I guess predictable is wrong too. I don't know. She's fascinating. And
well, I think it's interesting that her friend is like, talks about her wanting to, you'll do anything to win, which I don't actually necessarily think is like an accurate descriptor of her, because I do think she has these lines that she won't cross, which is interesting when you're talking about a character who is introduced to torturing someone, because that's a pretty big line
to cross.
That's a pretty big line. And I also think the definition of what she views as winning is very different than some of the other politicians that she's interacting with.
Or politicians we know.
Yeah.
Or recognize as.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think in this political context, anyone talking about anything first is alarming.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But she.
Which in 2015, they had no idea about.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Rewatching it, you're like, ooh.
You're like, she's great. Does anyone have anything else to say about Christian or any non-spoiler point?
I did want to go back to the visual storytelling question, because there is a couple. This is kind of a bloody visual storytelling moment, but I love how, I was going to say beautiful, but it's disturbing. But when Shed dies, the way that is shot and shown.
Oh, yeah.
Is so affecting.
Oh, man.
It's very good horror filmmaking.
Yeah. It's just, and I'm someone who has a really hard time with gore. Like, I definitely watched that scene knowing what was going to happen with kind of through my fingers. But also, yeah, just the way they show being on a spaceship and how that affects that gruesome death is amazing to me.
Yeah, everything in these last four episodes, you know, this is not Star Trek. This is not carpeting and you know, space lounges, you know. And in that scene, there's the shock of the shot going through the hall, going through their room, and taking Shed out completely. But those characters who have been at each other's throats in that hold all the way through this, you know, suddenly there's a hole in the ship and they're on the verge of suffocating and there is no gravity. So you've got this slow motion stuff that I couldn't tell whether that was just for art or if it was supposed to demonstrate that, you know, they're in zero G or whatever. But they all start getting into survival mode. We have to find stuff, which I presume is all over the ship, you know, emergency patching supplies or whatever. But they have to patch the hole. They have to work together to survive. And that is just...
What?
It's for a scene in which a guy gets beheaded, it is almost beautiful storytelling.
It's a great filmmaking moment, because you don't see him get beheaded. You just see the results of it first, and then afterwards they punch it up with actually having his head there. But it's also pushing the story forward, because not only is he beheaded, which is like a booga booga moment, but besides that, now you have to deal with the consequences of that, and that's visual too. So it's really well done. Also, as a goreologist, because I very much enjoy horror gore when done well, The Expanse does it very, very well. And the other thing I like about it is that, like you said, Chip, space is not safe in any way. They make a point of telling you that.
Yeah, and to go off of Warren's point of you see the results before you see the actual, like, effect or thing they're responding to, I think you know, to be more specific, you see the character's reactions to the fact that this person, their coworker, is just gone like that. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, Jen and I have a lot of the same storytelling interests because we grew up watching a lot of the same things together. But I also am not a huge fan of gore. And I think the reason, one of the reasons that might be is I'm just, I personally get like disturbed when there's gore without emotional context or reaction, mm-hmm. and which can happen. And, you know, also depending on like, yeah, what the story is trying to do can also, it can also be included. And I think the fact that they have so much emotional context around that moment is, you know, maybe what makes it beautiful, for want of a better word, but also makes it far, it is gore that I guess I like, because I feel like people are responding to it in a way that makes sense to me. Yeah, and that tells us so much about this world, like you all were saying.
Yeah, like my horror movie rule is it's either gore that is there for a reason, mm-hmm. or is funny. If it's just outright gore for no particular, then you're like, well, who cares? Like, this is just dumb. Like,
yeah, funny gore can be good too. Okay, we are now entering the spoiler zone. For those who haven't watched past episode 4 of the series, do not wish to be spoiled, now is the time to shut off the podcast. I hope you'll come back next week for our discussion of episode 5, Back to the Butcher, and episode 6, Rock Bottom. Sounds like a cheery duo. You can subscribe wherever good podcasts are found and follow us at Legit Salvage on Twitter. For everyone else, let's dive into the spoiler-filled discussion. So one of the things that is really important in the Remember the Cant, or one of the main storytelling devices, is this interrogation of the future Rossi crew. And we learn a lot of details about their backstories that I didn't necessarily remember. And I'm curious what that experience was like for all of you. Did you remember these details about like Holden's naval past?
No.
Yeah. I guess, yeah, and I don't think I was annoyed by that. But I don't think I was annoyed by it, even though usually I might be kind of like, well, this is obviously a throwaway detail. I don't know, yeah. How did you guys all feel about those character reveals?
It was nice. I got the comics that are available on Comixology, and I think they were all in comic shops as well, so if you like your comics in paper, you certainly can get them. But there are some prequel stories out there in comic book form about the Rocinante crew, as well as Joe Miller. And they are basically just like 24-page expansions of these little conversations that you have. So you see Holden trying to and failing to deck his superior officer. You see Alex struggling with being a former Mars pilot and stuff like that. So, but it's nice to have. It's like we said in the pre-spoiler space. You know, it's character dump, and it's overdue for that. It's time to ground these characters and let us know who they are, especially as the cast shrinks to this core. Goodbye, Shad.
Farewell.
I'm fine with that. I mean, it's kind of funny for a bit there, but no.
I know. This wasn't a bad episode for him. He had a good run. And we talked last week about how Holden's character, especially in the first episode, didn't necessarily feel like they had like completely solidified who he would be and what role he would play. But that detail of him, like, yeah, trying to deck his superior officer and failing just feels so Holden to me, especially yeah, totally in relation does. To like, yeah, he's doing it for some. Yeah, because he senses that there's something like ethically wrong here.
Yeah. I think that, you know, the key to Holden's character is revealed in CQB, and it's a little on the nose. But when he has the chance to, when the stealth ship is really putting on the heat on the Doniger and he gets out of his restraints, there's a person on the deck and there's a gun on the deck, and Holden goes to the person on the deck and tries to help. Yeah. And that that speaks volumes about Holden's character. Otherwise, in these first four episodes, and I think for a good way out, I think Holden is actually Forrest Gump.
Kind of, yeah.
Yeah.
Because he's in, like you said, he's in the middle of all of this stuff. He just happens to witness and happens to see, and it makes such a big difference for the fate of the solar system.
Does that make the Martian captain, Lieutenant Dan?
Oh, the Martian captain?
Yeah, who I love. Yeah. She's great, actually. But anyway, yeah. Sorry, you were going to say what you loved.
Oh, I was going to say, I love the moment when they're, Lopez is trying to get Holden to the shuttle, and he's like, well, you don't leave anyone behind. And he's like, we're Marines. You just met these people. And I laughed out loud because, yeah, rewatching it, of course he would try to save these people, because we know that he then spends the next, you know, the rest of the next three seasons.
They're his family.
They become his family and his crewmates. But at this point, why does he have loyalty to these people? It is a good point by this guy who really just
that
wants...
That did baffle me a little too, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it does say, you do learn a lot about Holden in this moment. It's like, he doesn't want to be captain if he is, by some definition, but if he will still, like, care and try and have some sort of loyalty to this idea of crew or leadership and what it means to be a good leader.
Yeah, I think with Holden and Miller, both of them, I think we're really early in the process of the writers moving them from archetypes into actual characters.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Speaking of archetypes, the guy who's the interrogation person is very much the archetype, down to the ponytail. He looks like somebody from a Metal Gear Solid game, like he totally does. I mean, he kind of redeems himself later, but he's just so much of the I'm the evil dude with the ponytail who's gonna, you're gonna tell me what I need to know. I'm like, oh, really? This is a little on the nose, isn't it?
I'm so confused by his character. I don't understand the technology he uses to interrogate them, and.
Yeah, fish oil capsules from the top.
Yeah.
And therefore, I don't understand. Because he acts very differently, obviously, in interrogation, which I guess might be true of all interrogators.
Yeah.
I mean, it's maybe not worth discussing because he doesn't stick around very long. But
well, yeah. No, I think it is a little worth discussing that he's, I'm going to drop another Babylon 5 reference. I apologize. But there are characters on that show that are psychics that are governed by an oppressive organization called PsyCorps. And at first, when I saw this, because I've got that language in the back of my head, I figured that Lopez was, you know, some sort of they have telepaths on Mars or something. I think that those are focus drugs, and I've seen references to them online where he takes the drugs and you see his eyes dilate and stuff like that. And I think it just makes him more keenly attuned to the physical cues, makes him a human lie detector, I guess. It is unclear, and he does shift from being this unearthly military intelligence character to a gun-toting armor-clad Marine. but he becomes more interesting as it goes on. He's the unearthly interrogator, then he's the Mars loyalist who really. Has no use for Holden as an earther, and then a Marine devoted to the cause. You know, that's a lot of territory that he goes through in two episodes. But he's interesting at the end. And you know, it would have been nice to see an ocean on Mars. You know, what an epitaph. You know,
and they give him these beautiful lines of dialogue, which doesn't necessarily fit with the rest of his character. It's also a beautiful line when you remember, like, when the scene when Bobby finally sees an ocean, which is one of my favorite scenes of the whole show, I think.
Oh, yeah.
And seeing this again, having seen that, yeah.
That's such a good point.
I love that part.
One thing I find super interesting is, and they're just kind of establishing it here, is the dynamic between what Mars is like and what Earth is like and what the belt are like politically, and how Earth is kind of not given up, but it's just kind of treading water, and how Mars is where the action is, really, and how the belt is kind of the scrappy upstart. And I, just to make it really shallow, I was like, oh, so Mars is like China, and Earth is like America, and Canada is like the OPA, because we're basically resources and empty.
I know. I feel like there's so many moments in this episode where there's rhetoric used that I, as an American, see, or just an American watching media, probably more accurately, like here, used to describe like socialism or communism, but it's not always used in relation to the Martians. Like, there is a point at which they are talking about like working towards a common goal, and like it feels very like Soviet, like rhetoric around Soviet mm-hmm. Russia. But then there's like Lopez talking about Earth, and it is different. It's like talking about, I guess, like the socialism of everyone getting like a certain
universal basic income,
which I guess is maybe more of a modern, in the United States uses like slander, or like, you know, be like, you don't want to be like socialist Europe or whatever. I don't know. There's just lots of language used that I recognize from other spaces, and usually, or a lot of times in television shows, that kind of annoys me. But because the world building in this is so strong, and those framings, I think, are like, yeah, just like weapons or a tool that's used in lots of different situations. It just makes total sense. And I really got a lot out of and found interesting.
And I should rephrase that as China, but libertarian China. so not China at all, because that doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. And I think it's good. Like, it's a problem when you're watching something and you're like, oh, this is this place in our world and this is this place, and it's too easy. You know, like, it shouldn't just be a direct parallel. Or at least for me, like, I'm not a fan of stories that are like that direct of a parallel to our real world. I'd rather have it be like, there are things that are like, you can understand, or patterns that you recognize from the real world, but it's more complicated. It has its own like geopolitical structure, and mm-hmm. it's not a one for one. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we also see in these two episodes, especially Remember the Cant, the beginnings of Holden's message getting out there, and knowing what's coming. Like, this is such an important moment, and you know, it's just a snowball that keeps going. So yeah, in the context of now, and also moving forward with the series, how does Holden's message help or hurt many different factions? Or also, like, as a storytelling device, how is it used here to maybe, you know, make the world feel more connected or smaller in some ways?
I mean, it does tie everything together, which is nice. When you're on the belt and you're seeing everybody watch his message, you're like, oh, okay, these things are actually tied together. So it does work to sort of make it more cohesive, I think.
Yeah, I love the automatic graffiti of Holden's face just showing up like an mm-hmm. Obama poster. Mm-hmm. Or
I know, I'm like, his face is so pretty. It's perfect for this sort of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. I had completely forgotten that, you know, in the first two episodes, episodes one and two, that there was sort of detente between Earth, Mars, and the belt. You know, and they're going to be at each other's throats from this point on, after Holden's message gets out. His message changes everything, at least until the point where they figure out that they've all got to work together to deal with the Ring Gate all the way back at the end of the third season. But it's kind of striking that, you know, he makes this broadcast that says that Mars blew up the Cant, and then the very next episode he discovers that no, they didn't. Well, and he's got to fix this somehow.
Mm-hmm. So he's basically Logan Paul. This is my apology video.
Well, I wouldn't go that far.
No, maybe not. Yeah, he's actually seems intelligent and not terrible, so yeah.
Yeah. I am interested, as someone who hasn't read the books and going into season four, how Holden's like celebrity will or won't play a role as he continues to, like, I don't know, go out into the universe, and I don't know, maybe it won't play a role at all, but I feel like that's something I forget, that like people actually know his face because it has mm-hmm. been everywhere, or it has been a lot of places.
Well, and there's that reality show that they do yeah. very briefly for like, was that season 2 or 3 somewhere in there?
Yeah.
Which they're mostly irritated by.
The documentary, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so he's like very famous. And I feel like they haven't done as much with that as they could if they want to. It's not something that I'm like, why haven't they explored this? But it is something that if they wanted to, I think that could be a really interesting part of his character and part of this world to explore.
Yeah, there's not a whole lot of media, social or otherwise, in the Expanse universe. They just don't really cover that.
But there is media. There's people watching other idiots driving around to asteroids and getting themselves killed. Because exactly. there's a whole thing later.
Good
where
point.
On it.
Good point. Oh, including in that was so great that you reminded me of that, Warren, because obviously the Ringgate stuff is the Belter, you know, discovering that there's a speed limit, you know, when he tries to fly through it, and
yeah.
it's the same. I had forgotten that they seeded this sort of thing, this popular culture of. Belter rocket jocks,
and they
seeded it here in this episode.
So good. I guess this is the benefit of adapting books that are like that far ahead.
Yeah, if you're not a madman who's plotted out all the seasons ahead of time, but you've got a series of books, then you're in great shape, unless you're great Game of Thrones.
yeah, but you could definitely tell when Game of Thrones ran out of story or ran out of book. And here that's not the case. So yeah.
Yeah, they're totally taking their time.
I was looking at the Wikipedia for this episode, and one of the things they mentioned is that the slingshotting racers actually don't get introduced until the third book. So it is interesting that they were like, oh, we'll put this in early on. So then when it does become relevant in, you know, the third book, the third season, whatever, I don't know how those line up. So that, yeah, it is the benefit of being like, oh, if we just throw this in.
Being the second draft in some way.
Yeah, yeah.
I also read that the character who Christian, like her old friend, Frank, the Martian ambassador, isn't a character in the books, which I thought was interesting because I think illustrate the flip side, which is the show is partially so good because it has this blueprint to follow, but also it's the best kind of adaptation in the sense that it isn't afraid to add characters or moments or plot lines that weren't in the books, but make sense for the story they're trying to tell. And that's looks very hard to do.
For sure. Yeah. And this is why I'm afraid to start on the books. You know, I don't think I can handle two different versions of The Expanse in my head at the same time.
No, I don't think I can either.
Christian is a later addition to the books than she mm-hmm. is in the TV series. I think Havelock is part of the story more so than here. I mean, they spike him and then they file him and then he's done on this show. And I don't have a clear understanding of why, because apparently the character had more to do in the books.
Yeah. Do you, watching it a second time, do you find it hard to be invested in characters that you know aren't going to be around for very long?
No, because I've forgotten. And they aren't very redshirty. Like, there's more to them than redshirts. They just show up, look at a thing, go, hey, Captain, and they get killed.
Yeah.
They usually try and put a little more work into it than that.
Yeah.
There's a woman on the Martian ship who I couldn't remember if I recognized her because she stays around or... But then I realized I recognized her from this other Canadian television show, Strange Empire. So I was just like...
Oh, wow, yes.
Yeah, I was just like, oh, but yeah.
It could have just as easily...
It's one of... Yeah, could have easily been like, oh, she's... But then I was like, it doesn't make sense that she would get off the ship. But I was confused.
So this is an added thing as a Canadian, because I will see people from you've seen forever. And you're like, oh, that person, because they're in every Canadian show, right? Mm-hmm. And a bunch of American ones that happen to be filmed here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's usually a sign they're going to get killed, honestly.
They're going to be on something else next week.
Yeah.
But you're right. The show is, like, much better at red shirts in the sense that, like, someone like Captain Yao, like, I thought she was around so much longer based on like my remembering her and thinking she was so interesting. So just because, you know, they don't stick around, whether either because they're killed off or for some other reason, doesn't mean they don't serve an important narrative role or roles. I guess that's the point, mm-hmm. roles, because red shirts in their like strictest sense serve like one role.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's not what The Expanse is about. They're about complexity.
But it's also like Game of Thrones and Walking Dead in that you don't know who could die when, except for like the main crew, I guess, here. But even then, who knows? Like you have that whole feeling of anybody could bite it. It's that kind of show.
Mm-hmm. You know, we talked about subjects that are introduced in these early episodes that become very relevant in episodes we've seen. But are there any aspects of these episodes that are introduced that have yet to come to fruition that you might be like, is this going to be important? This seems relevant, or this is a question that hasn't been answered that I want to have answered.
I feel like I need, and this is stuff that I've missed because, you know, three seasons worth dense storytelling. I need to understand a little bit more about who the guys are on the stealth ship. I know that they're part of the Protogen Corporation. They're part of Jules Pierre Mao's conspiracy and all that stuff. But how they got together, how they got the resources, you know, I need to keep going through this season and get caught up on that because it's a bigger part of the story than I currently can grasp.
Yeah, I feel like that story as it stands now kind of comes to fruition in this, like, the horror of Jules Pierre Mao torturing children and not in the larger, like, how does he have this is how I remember it, you know, like, how does he have all of this power? Real, mm-hmm. You know, I remember, you know, he collaborates with certain people, but it's like, yeah, how does he?
And who are these people, these mercenaries who are like, yeah, sure, we'll like blow up multiple ships.
And it takes its own sweet time telling you all this, too, as I recall. Like, it gets a little frustrating at first.
Yeah, I actually turned to Jen and was like, those are Jules Pierre Mao's ships, right? Like, I couldn't even totally remember, like, what the deal was. For me, one of the things that is still unresolved that I assume or suspect might come back, but maybe not, is something that's only hinted at in these episodes, which is when Naomi thinks she's going to die and she says, I never had the chance to say goodbye. And I think I read that as a reference to something you find out later, which is that she has a child, but it could be something else. And that's something that I'm really curious about that feels like it could become important, but also equally not, because I also think this is an unpredictable show that's also like these things that often define, especially female characters like Christian being a grandmother, or being a wife, that are like those things are those roles are not actually that important in terms of like all mm-hmm. of her identities. So maybe it won't come back, but this does seem important to Naomi and to Naomi's character. And it was something that came to mind when she said that, which it could have been in relation to something else. But that's obviously something that's still in my brain about her character that I'm like, what is going on here?
I love that scene because I just Amos and Naomi's relationship as just. Even though at some point he said, I would sleep with her if she let me, but like they're mostly a friendship. And but I love how it's a very complicated friendship because he kind of follows her around to figure out, you know, what to do. But I love that moment rewatching it because I originally loved it because I love that he takes the time to thank her for kind of taking care of him. Mm-hmm. But it also reveals so much in that moment that he has no idea what she's doing. She still keeps so many secrets, whether it's about her kid or it's about something else. He's kind of the closest person to her at this point in the show.
Yeah.
And there's still so much he has no idea about.
Exactly. And then when she reveals that she gave up the protomolecule to Fred Johnson and everybody on the Rossi feels betrayed, including him. Mm-hmm. And his reaction to that in conversation is to simply say, she's not the person I thought she was. Mm-hmm. And he just moves on. Again, that's Amos being Amos. You know, there needs to be a book, The Tao of Amos. You know?
Someone calls him, refers to him as the brute, maybe Lopez in this, in one of these episodes.
Yeah, he does.
And
he
it
does.
Just made me think about one of my favorite books is Frankenstein. And I realized how much Amos is like the creature in Frankenstein,
yeah, who totally is
such a good character and is similarly like very, I don't know, like very likable and very, I don't know, but like also doesn't understand totally how to connect emotionally or what a moral compass is, but like in spite of that wants to like do the right thing but just needs help doing it. I don't know. I never made that connection before, and maybe it's, you know, some people would argue with it, but I'm gonna think about that as we move forward with this rewatch.
Hey, he's a great, Wes Chatham's a great actor to get so much out of such a enigmatic and you know, I think Amos has lots of stuff going in there that's just real deep, but he will never show it to you. And I think it takes real talent to embody that as an actor.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he's a real cipher, and it doesn't get annoying, which it should.
Yeah.
But it doesn't.
It's impressive. I think he's very much the character. You know, like, oftentimes I'm very annoyed by male characters who aren't necessarily revealing very much. But I'm always fascinated by him. I'm always watching him when he's on screen, because even when he's not revealing that much emotion, there's, it just feels like there's so much going on underneath the surface with him.
See, that's what bugs me about Miller, because Miller acts that way too, but it seems like more of a put on so he can get ladies.
Yeah.
We all knew this guy in college, and he is that guy in college, except old.
Yeah, Amos is never manipulating people, as far as I can tell. Mm-hmm. And that is a rare quality in both the TV character and perhaps, I don't know, to a certain extent in real life.
Right. Which makes it interesting that he kind of adopts, trying to Prax. Remember the name of the Prax in season two. And talk about an odd couple.
Yeah, they're so great. Something to look forward to in future episodes.
I've completely forgotten about this, so I guess I am looking forward to it.
Did anyone have any final thoughts about these two episodes?
The Rocinante, finally, you know, the legitimate salvage debuts, and we don't really get the sense at the end of CQB just how big a deal that ship's going to be. The Incomparable Network that we're hosted on, we did an episode of the flagship podcast, The Incomparable, where it was a spaceship draft. And we took turns picking spaceships from various media as our favorites. And once you selected one, nobody else could pick it. And the Rocinante went early. And in CQB, at the end, you know, it's not even given a name yet. And it's just a ship that blows stuff up to get away. And that's all. But this ship turns into a big part of the series. It you know, the legitimate salvage, you know, this was the legitimate salvage operation, you know. I was happy to see the debut of the ship.
Yeah, you're right. It's such an important, I don't know, character introduction might be a strong phrase whenever people are like, the ship is a character, but it is a home. It's a setting. It's a, it's vital. Yeah,
it's not iconic in the same way that like the USS Enterprise is or something like that. It's a tool, but it's a beloved tool, and it has coffee, and it has coffee on it.
Yeah. Importantly, well, what it represents to these characters who have so little of, I guess, what it represents moving forward, which is like freedom, control, belonging. And having it be like a somewhat of a neutral space, which is kind of ironic, considering it is technically a Martian ship, where those sorts of allegiances are erased or superseded or complicated by an allegiance to something new and different that exists along totally different values, is pretty cool.
It's also just kick-ass. Like, that thing moves. And shoots.
Yeah. It's a pretty good, like, random, a legitimate salvage to salvage.
Yeah.
If you're going to legitimately salvage something, you want it to be this ship or something comparable.
Yeah. The moment when Alex just, like, shoots his way out of the docking bay, which, you know, if the ship's going to blow up, why not? It's just a cool way to get a ship. Just be like, all right, this is ours now. let's blow aside and build the ship before the whole ship explodes.
And that this is already the second time that they've been, you know, they've had to watch this massive ship filled with people on it just disappear into nothing in four episodes, is, or however long the span of time is that takes place in these episodes. Not very long. Yeah, I don't know if that has anything to say about that is, you know, relevant to the Rossi itself, but these guys have been through a lot and will continue to go through a lot as we move forward in this story. So thank you so much for joining us on A Legitimate Salvage. We'll be back next week to discuss episode 5, Back to the Butcher, and episode 6, Rock Bottom. Until then, remember the cant.